Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. You'll also hear Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick act as hosts to this thing called the Technical Net for the last lots of years. Technical Net has existed since 1982. We're going on our 29th year. And the main purpose of the Technical Net is education. A little bit of entertainment sneaks in from time to time. But wireless electronics has an awful lot to learn. Well, there's an awful lot to be learned about it. It's a rather complicated subject. And by my standards, the schools teaching it do only a mediocre job. The people who understand it well enjoy the industry and stay there. Those who don't understand it go back to teaching. So in some cases, you're being acclimated for a field by a teacher who is not able to acclimate himself. Some of that is taking place. The TechNet, we try to keep to a schedule where the people who signed in during the first hour get at least a brief answer, and hopefully a person doesn't have to wait more than 1 hour at least to get a partial answer to his question. After the first hour, a mail goes to his mailbag of the people who are just getting the ham radio license. Let me drop. And they don't yet have the ability to get on the air and talk to us directly, so they do it by way of snail mail and email. And they ask a series of questions. And there are times when Mel gets as many as 300 communications per week. And I'm kind of amazed that he can keep up with all of that. After that, Paul, the WS2N, our space expert, tells us what NASA has been doing, on the assumption that there's something significant going on there. And after that, we go into the deeper subjects, which not pleases everybody. To my knowledge, inside of every good ham radio operator, there's really a scientist trying to get out. And the way mankind really makes progress is to demonstrate curiosity about anything. And the process is usually a learning process. There's a whole series of people out there you'll meet that say, why are you investigating that? You're not going to get any money out of that. Or you're not going to get any fame and fortune out of that. Well, there's a hell of a lot of things you'd like to know about at the basic level, sometimes at the molecular level or at the atomic level, which will reveal other truths to you that you didn't anticipate. So many of the good scientists in the past didn't have a fame or economic motivation when they did their research, which allowed them to discover and develop significant things. So we go into those deeper subjects at the later portion of the TechNet. Know ahead of time that's going to take place. If that's what you don't like to listen to, then there's 800 channels on your 2-meter synthesized radio. You can tune to one of the other 799 channels. There are people who are not enjoying their life. They hear these people with curiosity enjoying the process, and so they think that they become disruptive. They can stop the people enjoyment, and they think it's going to increase their pleasure. Of course, that's a very convoluted kind of psychology, which probably doesn't work. So you'll hear disruptions going on from time to time. Let me drop. And when we hear those disruptions, we ignore them for a number of reasons. They eventually disappear, and we keep continuing. Second of all, if you give the person recognition, then you're giving him incentive to keep doing it. And third of all, you shouldn't be mad at the person doing the disruption. You should recognize the fact that he's got a problem of some kind. And that's what you're hearing. You're hearing the display of his problem. So instead of feeling anger for him, we should feel sorry for him, so to speak. And hopefully someday we'll bring him back into the fold of real ham radio operators and people who treat each other with kindness. That's a bunch of opinions, but it works for me. At this time, I'm going to take check-ins to the TechNet. A person gives Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need that sign-in just because you're listening. After 29 years, we believe there are people listening. We're convinced of that by now. 4 hours of TechNet for the last 6 years is a pretty strong piece of evidence that somebody cares about what goes on in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area. A lot of brain power here, and we try to tap into it by way of the TechNet. Not everything you hear is going to be 100% accurate at first. We all have batting averages less than 1,000. We make some mistakes, and eventually we correct those mistakes. Okay, give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW, listening.
Hey, I'll start. Good evening. K2KEY.
Mel checked in. We'll assume he has a question or a comment. That was a joke. He's one of our directors. Let's see. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
It's Roy White Joe, yes.
Okay. And WS2N. Good evening, Dick. With a space report.
Okay, Joe recognized and Paul recognized with a space report. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? I mean, because of the field day operation that took place this weekend, some of these guys are probably very tired, I know. I visited one particular field day site and stayed with them discussing all kinds of subjects until the sun rose. And then we decided to go catch some more shut-eye and go to sleep. So I made an all-nighter last night with a couple of guys from the Lockfield Amateur Radio Club. Didn't get a chance to go anywhere else this weekend. So there probably are people who want to give us a description of what the field day operation at their particular ham radio club was like. So give me a call at his name if that's what you got. So anyone else with any further questions or comments about field day, give me a call at his name at this time.
And to exchange with a quick question that would be about the reflection bridge.
Okay, reflection bridge. All right, Joe, you're number one on the runway. How are things in the world of digital television DXing? W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-H-U-R-I-W in the TechNet.
You ask that question. Each week I sign in with a question. And sometimes it's not always about DTV. Of course, today it is. My question is, what I've noticed is sometimes I can receive stations on low band, and I notice that turning the antenna at an azimuth of 30 to 40 degrees where I think the station's coming from, it doesn't seem to make much difference. This is sort of a curiosity question. I'm just wondering if by way of atmospherics or whatever, if the signal can actually be arriving not from directly at the antenna from a horizontal point at the horizon, but actually from a higher level in the atmosphere, which makes the antenna's directivity somewhat not exactly what you expect it to be. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, there's two or three different phenomena grouped together in your question there, Joe, and they're all related. In the case of 10 gigahertz, for instance, a few of the guys who are with their 2 and 3 foot diameter dishes on a tripod going to a waterfront or going to a mountaintop or a building top will switch the antenna back and forth on azimuth, peaking it up on the right beam heading to the guy who they know is on Mount Greylock, Mount Wachusett, Mount Equinox, Mount Washington, and so on. You know exactly where the guy is. You know what the great circle path to him is. Therefore, you know what the bearing should be. And quite often, 3, 4, 5 degrees to the left or to the right of that bearing, the signal will peak up. Sometimes the signal will peak up 3 and 4 degrees above the horizon. Since these guys are using a 3-degree beamless antenna, let's see, do I have a loose connection here? Because these guys have a 3 or 4 degree beamless antenna, sometimes a 2-degree beamless antenna, they can resolve these differences in azimuth and elevation. Let me drop. When I was using my array of 16 Yagis, which you can see in the March issue, 2008 CQ magazine, page 32 or 34, I think it is, you can see a picture of this array of 16 Yagis on 432. 19 elements per Yagi, 304 elements total, and that thing had like 5.5 degrees of beamwidth. Unfortunately, I didn't have an operational elevation control, but I did have an azimuth control, and there were times when the signal would arrive to me at least 5 degrees and sometimes 7 or 8 degrees off to one side, and in many of those cases it was aircraft reflection on the 432 meg band when talking to a guy like K4CAW, Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 miles airline distance from me, and we're transmitting single sideband back and forth for 4.5 years every Tuesday night from 7:30 to 8 o'clock. So we gathered a lot of data. Summer, winter, spring, and fall, what was long range over the horizon propagation like? He was 10 times my optical distance. My optical distance is 40 some odd miles, and he was 480 miles. And on a significant number of occasions, the signal arrived at some other azimuth or some other elevation angle, I'm pretty sure. Now, with the average guy on, say, for instance, 6 meters with, let's say, a five-element Yagi, where the antenna might have over 35 or a 40-degree beam width, all of my experience tells me that the majority of over-the-horizon signals are really coming from that horizon itself or a few degrees above it. When you look at the geometry of what's going on, let me drop. The vast majority of the signals that arrive at your QTH, as I see it, Joe, are arriving because of atmospheric inhomogeneity. That's the majority of it. In other words, little pockets of the atmosphere are hotter, colder, moving vertically or horizontally. They got the higher moisture, which gives them higher dielectric constant. There's all kinds of very minor changes in the dielectric constant of the atmosphere. They're called atmospheric inhomogeneities. They're like a minor little cloud. Sometimes you see them as a cloud. Sometimes they're transparent, but they're there anyhow. And the signal encounters these bubbles of slightly different material, and those bubbles, because they are slightly different dielectric constant, and you got a slightly different velocity of propagation, some of the signal propagates through, some of it reflects off, some of it gets bent into other angles. So the atmosphere is the major phenomenon. If there was nothing but dry, completely dry, uniform temperature air, or if there was no atmosphere at all on the Earth, all of those tropospheric propagated tropospheric signals, all of those over-the-horizon signals would drastically disappear, or they'd be many, many decibels, tens of decibels weaker. So the atmosphere is what's doing it. But on a geometry scale, when it comes to, let me pick a number, 100, 200, 500 miles, geometry-wise, that atmosphere is only 6 miles high, and you're talking about listening to a signal 100 or 400 miles away. Therefore, since the atmosphere is doing it, and the atmosphere is only 6 miles high, you can tell that there's very little altitude capability of the atmosphere to give you angle of arrival very, very different than that. If you made a really scale diagram of the Earth, and you used your globe that's on the table in front of you, so to speak, let me drop. The average high school kid or college kid or engineer, you ask him to take a piece of chalk and draw a cross-sectional view of the Earth with its atmosphere. They draw a nice circle that's maybe 6 or 8 inches diameter for the Earth, and then they draw the atmosphere around it of 2 or 3 inches in diameter. That's their impression. In reality, the Earth is 4,000 miles in radius, 8,000 miles in diameter, but the atmosphere is only 6 miles thick. That's very, very thin. So on your scale model of your globe, on your desk of the Earth, the thickness of the paint on that globe is approximately the thickness of the atmosphere. It's a very, very thin layer of stuff, very, very close to the Earth as far as the Earth radius is concerned. So when you look at that geometry, and now you pick out 2 points on that globe that are 500 miles apart, and you're listening to a broadcast station from 500 miles away, for instance, it's got to be coming from an angle that's only within a couple of degrees of the horizon, above, and sometimes below the horizon. The local air mass, very, very close to your house, could do some pretty exotic bending, and that for very short periods of time, you may see more than a couple of degrees of above the horizon. You may see 3, 4, or 5 degrees. Some of the guys who have done some careful measurements on that, on both 432 and 10 gigs, have occasionally seen 4 and 5 degrees above the horizon, but it's extremely rare. So since you're probably using antennas with 30 and 40 degrees of beam width, and since this phenomenon you're talking about in elevation is rarely more than about 3 degrees, you can see that a guy who mounts his 6-meter Yagi, let me drop. There are guys who have mounted their 6-meter Yagi on the mast, on the top of their tower, and they tilted the Yagi 30 degrees up on the horizon because they thought that that would emphasize meteor scatter and tropo and things like this. It doesn't. How much signal gets onto the horizon would count the most. So very rarely do you and I and any of the amateurs we know have antennas that are down to, let me say, the 1 degree beam width, where now the degrees above the horizon would be very critical to you. Almost all of us are using very, very broad beam antennas. So because of craziness of the atmosphere, clouds and whatever, I have on occasion heard a 432 signal arrive at my QTH a good 15 or 20 degrees east or west of the Great Circle Path. So the signal changing in azimuth very easily on occasion because of craziness in the atmosphere, reflection off aeroplanes or whatever. But in elevation, as you can see, most of the time I believe it's going to be a very narrow margin of elevation deviation. That's my impressions on the few years that I've been fiddling with that, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
K-2-K-E-Y, your comments.
Mel recognized, but Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Very interesting. I thought the ionosphere goes up a little more than just 5 or 6 miles above the Earth's surface, but anyway, I do get the picture of what you're talking about. It just is a funny phenomenon. I've noticed that you can turn the antenna sometimes 30 or 40 degrees, sometimes even 50. You don't seem to get as much drop in the signal as you think you would get, where if you're listening to something more locally, it's more like a gun sight, and when you go 20, 30 degrees off, you can start noticing a moderate difference in the signal level pretty quickly.
You're right about one thing, Joe. The ionosphere, which is not really the atmosphere, when you get to the very far above our atmosphere, much beyond 6 miles, I think some of the ionosphere is numbers like 30 and 40 kilometers. That's a good 30 miles up, so to speak, where the atmosphere is extremely thin. The individual air molecules are spread out very far. Therefore, when the ultraviolet rays come from the sun and ionize those, break away some of those electrons from each of those molecules, because the molecular spacing is so far, you now have a very long, what they call, mean free path. Each free electron or each free nucleus that's left over has to travel a long distance before it encounters another molecule that it can join up with and de-ionize itself. So your F layer, F1 and F2 layer, are up so high where the atmosphere is so thin that you have some real longevity to that ionization. As you get down to the thicker layers of the atmosphere, the mean free path is so small, the deionization happens so rapidly that at least during most of the day, the lower atmosphere ionization, if the sun isn't directly shining on it, it disappears real fast. But now think about something else. Yes, the ionosphere could be up at 30 or 40 miles of altitude, but you only get a good reflection off that ionosphere if the grazing angle is extremely shallow, very close to 0 degrees with reference to the plane of the ionosphere itself. So that ionospheric patch that's midway between you and that station you want to listen to 1,000 miles away, that particular patch is right on your horizon. Yes, there is a patch that's overhead to you 30 miles up, and that would be a very high angle on your antenna, but the geometry is such you're not going to get a grazing angle signal going in and coming out of that particular patch and therefore getting to your house. So when you start asking for much bigger...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
When you start asking for a much bigger angle of bounce off that ionosphere, the signal starts falling off in strength very, very fast. So there are higher angles of the ionosphere, but only for the patch that's close to you. That's not the one that's going to give you a reflection. It's only the one that's midway between you and that station 1,000 miles away. 500 miles away from you, 30 miles up, that's an extremely shallow angle. You can see the geometry of that one. K2KEY, wonder what experience you've seen on crazy angles of arrival of signals, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, I was going to bring up a very interesting fact. We no doubt see an auroral type of propagation at 2 meters. What happens as we go higher in frequency as far as auroral type of propagation, Dick? Over.
Not to worry, I had to go get something. Okay, as you go higher and higher in frequency, the amount of signal you get off the aurora starts falling off real fast. The guys on 10 meters and 6 meters will quite frequently see pretty strong signals off the aurora. The guys on 2 meters will occasionally get it. On 432, it starts becoming very rare, unless you've got a lot of gain on the antenna. Where I was running a 16 Yagi array, and I had a 5.5 degree beamwidth, 29 decibels of gain. In other words, if I could transmit a kilowatt into that antenna, if it had 30 decibels of gain, it had around 29, if it had 30 decibels of gain, if I could get a kilowatt to it, my signal coming out of that antenna would have an effective radiated power of 1 million watts. You aim an antenna like that at the ionosphere, and even though the echo on 432 is falling off real fast as a function of frequency, I don't know if it's frequency squared or frequency cubed, but either one, it falls off real fast. On 432, it takes a lot of steam to get an echo off the ionosphere, off the aurora curtain, and I've done that. And so I've listened to signals coming from the Midwest. When they aim to the north, they're sending a medium-strength signal to the aurora curtain, and I'm using my 5.5-degree beam with 39 dB gain antenna and aiming at the hot spots in the aurora. And I saw some very interesting phenomena there. I was getting signals at times 10, 15 dB above threshold. Sideband, of course, sounds like hell. Morse code, your beautiful tone starts becoming a rushing sound. The guy is sending a CQ in Morse code, and it's off the aurora curtain on 432, it sounds like... And you start tuning the receiver higher or lower in frequency, and you'll hear... That's the way it sounds as you tune the receiver across it. You can barely tell that the
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
You can barely tell that there was a tone there. There was a favored frequency region. But portions of that ionosphere are moving toward you, portions of it are moving away, and it's all being mishmashed together. On top of that, when you find the hot spot on the ionosphere, I'm not quite sure of the polarity what I'm about to tell you. I would swish this 5.5-degree beam with antenna back and forth and find the hot spot. And there were times it wasn't exactly due north. It would be as much as 15, 20 degrees away from the magnetic north where the hot spot would be. It drifted around. The hot spot would stay there for about 3 or 4 minutes, and the hot spot would slowly drift to somewhere else. And sometimes there was multiple hot spots as you would swish the antenna across the whole northern region. But as you found the hot spot and you tuned to what you think is the center of the signal, as you then wave the antenna a little bit to the left, the frequency that you heard increased. As you wave the antenna to the right, the frequency that you heard would decrease. It's as if the particles of the, let me think now, what's the best way to put it? The solar wind is putting out millions and billions of these charged particles. The charged particles hit our Earth's magnetic field. They therefore, because they're charged and hitting a magnetic field, they're forced to move in a direction that is parallel to the Earth's magnetic field. Earth's magnetic field dips into the North Pole and dips into the South Pole, and so those particles riding those magnetic lines of force hit the atmosphere at the North Pole, and when they do, they create further ionization of the atmosphere, and it gives you the green and blue and reddish glow that you get of the aurora curtain, and that aurora curtain is what I'm listening to. But those charged particles coming through that magnetic field don't travel exactly parallel to the magnetic field. They travel in a spiral manner. They spiral around the axis of the magnetic field line.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Therefore, as those ionized particles are entering the atmosphere and they're moving in a left-handed clockwise spiral manner as they descend into that magnetic pole. I may have the polarity wrong on this. I always saw this phenomenon where a little bit to the left of the hotspot, I would see a higher frequency because they're moving closer toward me in their spiral trajectory, and the ones away from the center of the hotspot to the right, when I steered more clockwise, I would hear a descending tone. So I could tell that there is a kind of spiraling phenomenon of the individual particles of the aurora curtain when listening to echoes on 432. When listened to a rainstorm on 432, like there was a guy running a beacon in the capital area of New Jersey, and he would near Trenton, and his beacon was something like 90 miles airline from me, well over the horizon, and I'm listening to this 10 gigahertz beacon, and there's a rain cloud somewhere in New Jersey, and I could aim my antenna directly at him, and I would hear a weak signal from him. I aim the antenna 20 degrees clockwise at him, and I'm now aimed at the center of this rainstorm going through New Jersey. And then as I listen to the echo from the rainstorm, I would hear some positive Doppler shift. The signal would be a little bit higher because that rain cloud is approaching me. It's going from the southwest toward the northeast, and it's coming closer to my Long Island location. As I tune to the left of the hot spot of the rain cloud, I would again hear a higher frequency on 10 gigs, and when I tune to the right, I would hear a lower frequency. We know that a storm always circulates around a low pressure center in a counterclockwise direction, the cyclone phenomena, top view. Therefore, portions of that rain cloud are again coming closer to me. They're approaching me. I get a positive Doppler shift when I turn to the left. So both on rain clouds and on...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Both on rain clouds and on aurora curtain reflections, I saw this phenomena of hot spots drifting around and some positive Doppler shift quite often when the curtain was approaching me or when the rainstorm was approaching me, and this phenomena of differential Doppler spread, it's called. As I listened to the left-hand side of the hot spot, I would see positive Doppler shift, and the right side of the hot spot, I would see negative Doppler shift. I wonder if you've ever heard anything along those lines. And probably not, Mel. Not very many people have used a 5-degree beam with a medium accuracy azimuth control on it where they could carefully aim the antenna and listen for these phenomena. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Well, you know, no doubt. I used to get that a lot on 75 meters during the so-called northern lights. You used to get that effect, that sound of like people were talking, you know. I'll explain, like in a tunnel sometimes. You would actually there were people that claimed. I think we once went about this once before. Do you really believe that they had claims that they could actually say, hello, let go of the mic button and hear their hello come back at them, Dick, over?
Yeah, those are called LDEs, long delayed echoes. The number of reports of long delayed echoes is so large in number, small in percentage, but large in number, I think there's something to it. Yes, it is possible that a guy listens to his buddy at a precise time, makes a tape recording, and then plays the tape recording back to him, and the guy's 100 miles or 400 miles away. That's possible. There's probably been a couple of hoaxes. But in order to really pull off that hoax, the careful timing that's required on recording, playback, rewind the tape and send it back to the guy, the fact that long-delayed echoes were being experienced long before there were convenient tape recorders in people's homes. Yeah, there were wire recorders, but very few people had them. And rewinding a wire recorder is and getting exactly back to the right spot in a short period of time, not easy. And the fidelity you get off of one of those is kind of marginal. So the number of hoaxes that we've had during those LDE incidences, I think, was very, very minor. I think LDEs are a reality. When you look at the number of seconds of delay of an LDE, you'll come to the conclusion of one of two things. Most of the time, I believe it is not a terrestrial phenomena, unless it happens to be a crazy propagation where the signal wraps all the way around the Earth two or three times and then comes back to your QTH. Very, very unlikely. Not impossible, but very unlikely. However, there are those two Lagrange points, number 4 and 5, in space. In other words, you look directly at the moon. The moon is roughly 240,000 miles away. Let me drop. And while you're looking at the moon, you sweep your hand 60 degrees to the left of the moon or 60 degrees to the right of the moon. If you put massive objects in that exact location, the lunar distance, 60 degrees ahead of the moon compared to the Earth's center location, and 60 degrees behind the moon, material placed in Lagrange point number 4 and 5 are thoroughly stable. In other words, if you manage to get the material there with zero velocity, it'll stay there forever. It'll be a Earth-Moon stuff triangle, 60-degree exactly equilateral triangle. And because of the way the gravity gradient acts between Earth and Moon, and there's moving dynamics of these things in orbit around each other, you could say that the Moon is around the Earth, orbits around the Earth. That's simplistic. Earth and Moon are really a binary pair, and they're moving around their mass center. And that mass center is a point roughly 1,000 miles below the equator of the Earth. 3,000 miles from the center of the Earth, 1,000 miles below the equator, is the mass center of the Earth-Moon system. So Earth and Moon are both rotating around that epicenter, that mass center, Barry center it's called. Therefore, if you studied the exact motion of the Earth in a 28-degree day period, you would see that the Earth is wobbling once per 28 days, and it's moving in a 3,000-mile radius in its wobble, because the Earth and Moon are really a binary system. So because of that phenomenon, that binary system, something that's 60 degrees ahead of the Moon, from our point of view, is in a stable location. So you put enough stuff there, whether it be a sudden gathering of particles during a great big coronal mass explosion. Let me drop. I mean, is it possible for a burst of stuff during a coronal mass expulsion? You've got a whole lot of solar wind of charged particles leaving the sun at roughly a million miles an hour, arriving near the Earth-Moon binary system, being deflected and attenuated and pushed around by the Earth's magnetic field, and could a great big cloud of those particles end up at Lagrange point number 4 or 5, or both at the same time, have them dwell there for a long enough period of time that you get a significant amount of ionospheric-like bounce off of that, and that would give you a 2.5-second delay. If any of those LDEs are exactly 2.5 seconds, which is the amount of time you get for a signal to go to the Moon, bounce off of it, and come back, and Lagrange points are at the exact same distance from the Earth. So if you had 2.5-second delays on LDEs, you've got a fairly simple explanation with Lagrange point 4 and 5 and the possibility of, at least for periods of time, the right of kind of material there that could give you an echo. So at least there's a possibility. So for the time being, I stay a little bit skeptical. Not all of the LDE claims I think are real, but I think some of them could be real, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, sounds plausible. Some of it may be a great hoax, and some of it may be something scientific happening there that may be a little bit a little far-fetched, because I've heard of the LDEs, and some of them have made some extravagant claims of even into hours, not a minute, hours, Dick. So I don't know. I've it's an interesting thing to think about, but I just can't get wrap my mind around a factor that maybe you could send your signal out and come back and listen to it. That even a few minutes later, I would say that was quite something to behold, but not into many of them staying hours. Or there was one claim, I think, from Japan. A guy said he was able to pick it up, a day later or so. All right. Anyhow, yeah, it's getting late. Go ahead on with the TechNet.
Yeah, when it comes to some kind of reflection off of phenomena within the atmosphere of the Earth and very, very short delays, they're a lot easier to accept. When it comes to 2.5 seconds of delay with Lagrange point 4 and 5 in the Earth-Moon system, reasonably easy to accept once in a while. But when you start getting into hours of delay, and now the distance is getting to, a Jupiter and Saturn-like distance, and yet Jupiter also has Lagrange points, 60 degrees ahead of Jupiter as far as the Sun is concerned, and 60 degrees behind Jupiter. But now you've got a problem, and that is, the size of the reflecting cloud has to increase square law to give you the same amount of echo. Because of inverse square law, a signal going the much, much greater distance out to Jupiter or Saturn and that Lagrange point, and then having enough area, it's what's called a radar cross-section. So, I mean, the amount of echo you get on a radar is a function of how much radio area that airplane presents to you, and also what is its range. As the range falls off at 1 over range 4th, you get a weakening of the signal. So it takes a much, much bigger airplane to give you a good size echo on a radar screen if the airplane is further away. So by that token, the amount of area of requirement to give you a great big echo at a distance that gives you a 1 hour delay, now it's becoming much more difficult to accept that. And all of that area must be a co-phase echo. In other words, it must be a sheet of material where all of the sections of that sheet are the exact same distance from you, so that they all give you an echo that is co-phase. It's becoming very, very difficult. Not impossible, but we're getting way into the law of diminishing returns here. So, I know we've deviated from your original question, Joe, but
there's one more possibility, Dick.
I'm listening, Barry. Hey, Barry, how many people have you heard that you think are credible that have heard LDEs? N2 Moon Bounce, K2RIW in the TechNet.
OK,
Okay, I have never heard a credible LDE.
Hmm.
However, I often thought that it was possible for a signal to go all the way around the Earth, and you should hear it coming around second time. Why not, you know?
But around the Earth one full time, 25,000 miles, is going to give you a quarter of a second of delay. And a quarter of a second delay, yes, it would sound like a funny kind of echo, but it's not one of these things where you release the mic and now you hear your voice speaking a couple of words when the total delay is only a quarter of a second. So one time around the Earth, quarter of a second. Yeah, if it was 10 times around the Earth, it would be 2.5 seconds. But what's the probability of the signal going around the Earth 9 times and missing you and coming around the 10th time, still having enough signal strength left, and now in landing at your QTH? You can see the mathematics of that starts getting very, very difficult. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, and the ionosphere is what we're talking about, and that's not at surface level. It's a little higher, so you might be able to add a few more parts of a second to that because it is a little higher in elevation, you know?
Yeah, each time I pass it back to you, you got to wait for the beeps, Barry, otherwise you might time out. You haven't timed out. One of the really fun puzzles to give a person, assume you had a string that has absolutely no stretch to it, and the string goes all the way around the equator and now comes back and you've tied a knot. But you release the knot because all of you and your friends are going to help you, and they're all going to lift that string 1 foot above the Earth, everywhere, all the way around the equator. That one extra foot of altitude, because you're doing it over 25,000 miles, sounds like it would really be a hell of a lot of extra string. The answer would be, it would be 3 feet of extra string, pi. Pi times the diameter, if you know what I mean. So by everybody raising the string 1 foot, maybe it's 6 feet, because you're doing it on both sides of the radius, so to speak. But it's a very small number of feet of change when you raise that extra altitude all the way around. When you look at the Earth's atmosphere on a scale model of your globe that's on your desk right now, the atmosphere has a thickness of about the thickness of the paint on that globe. The ionosphere is about 10 times higher than that. And so 10 times the thickness of the paint on your globe is the height of the ionosphere. That's not going to add a hell of a lot of extra length on one swing around. You see where I'm going on that one, Barry. N2 moon bounce, wait for the beep, K2RIW.
Okay, I can accept that. So that's one more shot we couldn't do. Unless, of course, you were listening to a third or a second or a third trip around the world. Okay. Sounds fair. Back over to you. N2MB, Rocky Way Beach.
Far Rockaway Beach. You're far out, Barry, and far Rockaway. Yeah, each trip around the Earth at the speed of light is about a quarter of a second. So that's not going to give you very much of an LDE. And multiple trips all the way around the Earth, which is worse than long paths, if you know what I mean. It's getting hard. So I believe the LDEs are taking place in space, and I think they're rare events. You also could see the possibility of when the sun gives you a burst of coronal mass expulsion, where it's putting out billions of pounds of stuff in one great big blast because the sun's magnetic field got itself tangled up in some kind of a really crazy knot, and you can see that tangling of the knot by way of the sun's spots. That's where the sun's magnetic field has done some crazy things. That's what makes those black spots on the sun when you use the right kind of a filter and look at the sun for sunspots. And every so often one of those knots will untie itself violently, and a big blast of stuff comes out of the sun. And as that blast of sun stuff is coming at you at roughly 1,000,000 miles an hour, and it's 93 million miles away, so it's going to take, 93 hours to get here in theory, that stuff as that cloud comes toward you could easily form itself into an exotic shape. It's highly ionized material, charged material. And so if your antenna happens to be aimed in that direction, you could get an echo off of that blast or that cloud of stuff that's on the way toward us. So that's another possibility that I would sort of accept. As I said before, Joe, we're way off subject here, but I thought you'd get a curious, get some kick out of some of the stuff. WHURYY for any other comments. KQRYW on the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. I have a more technical question, but I guess I'll answer that maybe a little later on in the TechNet, unless you want me to throw it at you right now. I don't know if there's anybody else on the list or not. I wasn't paying much attention to that.
Yeah, there's one other guy on the list, Wesley, with what he believes is a quick question. And I'm going to jump ahead on one of the things that I heard Wesley and John talking about. I guess it was yesterday while I was driving from point A to point B, and I was only going to be in the car for a couple of minutes. I heard them describing to each other a slotted line and how long the slotted line should be at which frequency and what polarization you get out of it and so on. So I thought I'd give these guys a couple of words on a slotted line. A slotted line is the more modern equivalent of a lecture wire system. Back in the days when most of our transmission lines were two parallel wires with wooden sticks and other things, pieces of plastic in between the two wires as a parallel transmission line, twin lead, so to speak, and you slide a metallic object across that with a neon bulb on it, you can see the standing wave. You get a visualization of the standing wave on your twin lead transmission line. That was the popular kind of transmission line and how you measured VISWAR back in, let's say, 1930. Let me drop. Along came World War II, and all of a sudden, coaxial cables started becoming very popular. And the good news of coaxial cables is a shielded structure, slightly unbalanced as to what's going on in the inner conductor versus the outer conductor, but it's a shielded structure. You don't have to be careful about going around corners and laying things on top of it and so on. There's a whole lot of rules you had to obey with twin lead. Once you've got the coaxial cable and you want to reestablish something like your lecture wire VISWAR measuring system, they came up with a slotted line. Somebody was smart enough to realize that if you cut a slot that's narrow and it's in the longitudinal direction in the outer conductor of a coaxial cable, that by ham radio standards, that slot will not radiate. If I moved myself along the transmission line, if I stop time, and I move myself along the transmission line, and I choose the spot, I stop the signal from transmitting, I stop time, and I choose the spot where the signal on the center conductor is a positive voltage at this instant. And I slice through the coax cable, and I look at it down in the actual manner. The round center conductor is positive. The outer conductor, by comparison, is negative. And your E-field lines are all flowing in a radial manner from the center conductor toward the outer conductor. So you've got radial lines going at 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, all the way around the compass. You've got lines of E-field going from center conductor toward outer conductor. And if because of the slot I cut in my outer conductor, when I see it in as a slice in cross-section, that slot that I cut might be at the 9 o'clock position. And now if I look at the E-field lines that hit the outer conductor at 9:30 and 8:30, a little bit of clockwise of the slot and a little bit counterclockwise of the slot, you realize it's a thoroughly...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
You realize that that's a thoroughly equipotential system. In other words, the 9:30 portion of the above the slot and the 8:30 portion of the outer conductor below the slot are at the exact same potential. There is no voltage across the slot. Even though you cut that slot, you know, maybe an eighth of an inch wide, and you cut it maybe a foot long, that holds on slot with a well-centered coaxial center conductor on that coaxial cable, the slot will not radiate. It's still a shielded structure, even though if it was a piece of airline, you look through that slot and you're looking at the center conductor. You're looking at the thing that's got the high voltage on it when you're transmitting a kilowatt of power. You're looking right at it. You could put your eye right up against that slot and it would be safe. No signal radiates from that slot of a slotted line. Now I take my probe, because I want to do a standing wave ratio measurement, and my probe goes down into that slot, and it's on a carriage where I can slide it along the outer conductor in the axial, in the longitudinal manner. I can slide it in the Z-axis, further down or further up the coax cable is my little probe. The probe does not touch the center conductor. The probe simply goes down a little bit beyond the surface of the slot. It starts sensing the presence of the E-field that's flowing from center conductor to the outer conductor. and connected to that probe on the outside is your diode detector, and it goes into your standing wave ratio meter, which measures the amount of 1,000 hertz modulation, because most of the time when you're using a slotted line, the way the whole system works with the Hewlett-Packard 405 standing wave ratio meter, or is it 415? The 415 standing wave ratio meter is looking for exactly a 1 kilohertz note. So if the radio signal...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The radio signal that you're putting into your, that you're making with your transmitter, that is going down the coaxial cable where you wish to measure the standing wave ratio, it must be amplitude modulated at a 1 kilohertz rate in order to operate your 415 Viswa meter with a slotted line. So it's picking up a RF signal with that probe. It's sensing the E-field. The E-field is going up and down in amplitude at a 1,000 hertz rate. The diode rectifier is rectifying that RF envelope, and out comes a video signal that's 1 kilohertz. And the magnitude of the 1 kilohertz signal is what the Hewlett-Packard 415 measures. And it's got 60 or 80 dB of dynamic range. It's got a great big click-click knob on the front, and each click is changing the scale. The Dawson valve movement from left side to right side represents something like 10 decibels of change, and you can read very accurately with that machine. So the slotted line is a thoroughly shielded structure. The probe you put into there, you could say it's got horizontal vertical polarity. That doesn't have any meaning, because the probe is going inside of a shielded structure, and it only goes a small depth. You've got an adjustment device on the outside of that carriage, which is adjusting the depth of the probe, which determines the sensitivity. If you're running a kilowatt, you put the probe in very little. If you're running 1 watt, you have the probe in a little bit further in order to pick up more of the signal in order to get full-scale deflection on your instrumentation. So that probe is sensing the E field in the slotted line, and as you slide it up and down and you look for the peak and the valley, which are a quarter wavelength apart. You measure the magnitude of the peak, you measure the magnitude of the valley, and if you saw 20 decibels of difference between the two, and that's a power measurement, that would be a 10 to 1 voltage ratio.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And that would be a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio. Voltage standing wave ratio, even though the meter is measuring decibels of power, or you could say it's measuring voltage but multiplying by 20 times the log, so it becomes the equivalent of power. So the peak and valley in magnitude of voltage or in decibels, and you use the right formula, you can now figure out what your standing wave ratio is. So that probe itself is not really of any particular polarity. In the ideal world, you'd like to have a slotted line that is a minimum of a quarter wavelength long at your operating frequency. Therefore, you stand a very good probability of sliding it along in the Z-axis and finding a peak and finding a valley and taking the ratio between the two. But for a smart amateur, there's a way around this. Let me drop. Say you buy a particular slotted line that has a particular length that is good only down to 500 megacycles. Maybe that one is a foot long, so to speak. Maybe it's a good down to 200 megacycles, 250 megacycles, because it's a foot long. And you want to make the measurement at 100 megacycles. There's an easy way you can do that. You only are going to be sliding that probe in that slot, looking for the peak in the valley. And at your particular operating frequency, if you happen to know that the peak in the valley must be a quarter wavelength apart, and that quarter wavelength at your particular frequency might be 2 feet, and your slotted line is only a half a foot long, all you've got to do is add a precision length of coaxial cable on the output end of the slotted line, between the slotted line and the load that you wish to measure the standing wave ratio of. Maybe it's your antenna. So if you've got a couple of pieces of coaxial cable that you slip in there between the output end of the slotted line and the beginning of the transmission line to your antenna, and you put in one of those longer pieces of cable, assuming that it's very low in loss, and you can even correct for the insertion loss of the cable, but I won't go there right now. You put in the right length of line, and now you move the carriage back and forth, and you find the null. But there isn't enough length to the slotted line where you can slide it far enough to get the peak. Then you take out that particular piece of coax cable and make the whole length of line between your slotted line and the antenna. You make it either shorter or longer by roughly a quarter wavelength. And now the position on the slotted line that used to be the peak is now the valley. And so by you fudging the length of the slotted line, by inserting and extracting length of cable on the outside, you now, you don't have to have an exact length of cable because you're not trying to measure the exact impedance.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You're just trying to find the magnitude of the peak and the magnitude of the valley. The exact position on the slotted line, as long as you really did find the peak and really did find the valley, the exact position on the slotted line doesn't matter. Once you measure the magnitude of the peak and the magnitude of the valley, you know the standing wave ratio. Yes, the next step beyond that is that now if you want to know not what the standing wave ratio of that antenna is, but is it 75 ohms of resistance and 31 ohms of reactance, and now you have to know exact positions. And now those pieces of coax cable that you add and subtract, you want to know their exact electrical length. And there's ways you can confirm that. So you can force a slotted line to go much, much lower in frequency. You could bring it all the way down to 1 megacycle if you want to, if you've got low loss pieces of long length coax cable and you're smart enough to know what you're doing. So I think there's a lot of information about slotted line standing wave ratio measurements that used to be given in all of the instruction techniques of, let's say, 40 years ago. Nobody uses a slotted line anymore. They do everything with a network analyzer, so they no longer teach this. As such, an awful lot of the theory of what's really going on inside of a coax cable is being lost, not being conveyed to the students. Maybe this helps a little bit, Wes. N2XJN, KQRIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN, DIGAM standard. I do very much thank you. I have a slotted line that is taller than me. And that one operates, if I remember correctly, from 100 megahertz. Now, and up. So, my question then would be, instead of me having a strayed coaxial cable that is connected to the slotted line, could I have it coiled to take less space in order for me to go below 1 megahertz and to exchange?
Whiskey Delta 8, Golf Echo Oscar, Cleveland.
Whiskey Delta 8, Golf Echo Oscar, recognized. Get to you in a second, sir. Absolutely. The good news about coaxial cable is it's in the ideal world, it's a thoroughly shielded structure. Therefore, what you do on the outside of the coaxial cable, coiling it, making right-angle bends, laying it against sheet metal, putting it under the carpet, putting a U-shaped tacking devices around it, as long as you don't squeeze too much, no matter what you do to the outside, within reason, does not change the nature of the signal on the inside of the cable. Only the signal crawling down the outside of the coax cable is interfered with by those things, if you know what I mean. And your slotted line is not using that. Your slotted line is considering everything a shielded structure. So you can put as much cable as you want, coil it any way you want, and you can still make those measurements by adding extra cable on the outside.
How can I then have a control over the impedance? I need 50 ohm.
Most likely the slotted line you bought is a 50 ohm slotted line.
Yes, it is, but then would that be with that coaxial cable all the time, 50 ohm?
When you're extending the slotted line by way of an external cable on the output end, I recommend you use 50 ohm cable. If you're really smart, even that is not a restriction. If you know exactly how many wavelengths of 75 ohm cable you put, and you put that 75 ohm cable between the output of the slotted line and your unknown load, and you want to make measurements and properly interpret it, the mathematics gets twice as complicated, but it is a deterministic situation. It can be thoroughly analyzed with 75 ohm cable as the extender on the 50 ohm system. I don't recommend you do that because there's a lot higher vulnerability. You've more than doubled the number of ways you can make an error in that calculation but you could do that. Let's find out what the Whiskey Delta 8 Golf Echo Oscar has to say on this subject. As long as you're talking about this particular subject, sir, start off with your name and tell us what you would like to say. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Dick, anything? This is Whiskey Delta 8 Golf Echo Oscar. The name on this end is George. On Micronode 7117 in Cleveland, Ohio. I just wanted to say that I am very impressed with the discussion that's going on. I did not want to get you off of a topic, but if you could, real quick, just give me an opinion, if you will, on a 2-meter, 70-centimeter cubicle quad antenna. And I will listen out and say 7-3 to you and listen to the rest of this net. Thank you very much. WDAGEO Cleveland.
Okay, very nice, George in Cleveland. Yeah, the people who sign in at 8 o'clock, we give them a promise that they're going to get at least a brief answer between 8 and 9 o'clock before we go to the other sections of the net. And beyond roughly 10 o'clock is when we get into the more serious subjects. So we may not get to you tonight, George, but you're allowed to sign in next week. we'll put you number one on the runway, if you know what I mean, because you signed in this week. As I said, we may not get to you tonight. What you're asking sounds like a simple question. I know it's not quite as simple as you think. All of these things, when you dig into them a little bit, except for creating misinterpretations, are not quite that simple. Let's see now. So, Wesley, I think you see the process. By adding and subtracting cable lengths, you're doing the electronic equivalent of stretching your slotted line. So the slotted line, if you're trying to measure the magnitude of the standing wave ratio, and by the way, George, I should tell you that the technical net you're listening to has existed since 1982, and you can listen to the last 1,500 hours of the last 6 years of the technical net are all recorded and documented at the website amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And no punctuation between the word amateur and the word radio. And you go there and you can play back these reels of tape, because each of the tech nets for the last 6 years goes on for 4 hours every Sunday night, and it's all recorded and documented. There's a lot of guys who can't stay up very late, therefore can't hear the tail end of the tech net. The next morning, or 3 days or so later, when that particular tech net goes on to the recording, they play it back into the recording device and listen to it as they're driving to work or shaving in the morning or whatever. They do time shift, if you know what I mean. So, and this particular technical net last week, last year.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, last year, this particular technical net was giving the ARRL, a board of directors, what is it now called, the Technical Assistance Award for the year 2010 is what this technical net experienced after 28 years of its existence. So we're sort of, Mel and I are sort of being recognized, if you know what I mean. I think you see the process. So when it comes to just finding the magnitude of the standing wave ratio, you only have to find the peak, add some cable, find the valley, or vice versa. If you now want to know the exact impedance, in other words, you know that it's a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, is it because the load is a 150-ohm resistor, or is it a 50-ohm resistor with 80 ohms of reactance, if you know what I mean, if that happens to be a 3-to-1. So to know the exact impedance, you now want to know exactly how far you have moved the carriage. And so with proper calibration of your cables, you can re-derive that information. And it's a little bit more difficult, but you don't have to have a slotted line that's a mile long because you want to make a measurement at 500 kilohertz. And by the way, once you learn what a directional coupler can do, and let me give you one of the hints on this one, Wesley, I could save you an awful lot of effort, time, and equipment buying, hardware, if you want to. And to have two techniques for measuring exact impedances also is a good way to go. Let me drop. If you go to the North Texas, what is it called, Roadrunners Group, I'll find out the exact email address for you later, but the Roadrunners Group of Northern Texas has a website which they also have something called the K2RIW Corner, where they've taken some of my online published notes on various things, and they put them all in one spot. And you go to the section on calibrating and using a directional coupler, and you read that particular